Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Knight.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
So what, do you know anybody in West Plains, Missouri?
I totally do. My very good friends, the writers Daniel Woodrell and Katie, still live there. And it's been way too long since I've visited them. You're making me feel bad.
But you need to call them, like, now, like, before next Monday.
I definitely need to call them, but I'm not sure. I don't know if I can get it done by Monday. I got a lot of stuff going on. Why do I have to do that?
No, you have to do it by next Monday, because there's going to be an eclipse on April 8th. And one of the places in Missouri where it will last the longest, 3 whole minutes, will be in West Plains.
Oh, my God. I thought all those weird glasses that I was seeing, I drove to St. Louis with my son a couple weeks ago, and there were all these weird, I was like, why are they selling these paper glasses at the front desk of all the gas stations? And that, I thought that was a joke. So that must be for the eclipse, right? Are you going to be able to see it in Minnesota?
Minnesota is just partial. So
as we've gone actually over before, Minnesota is partial compared to Missouri.
Minnesota, in this instance, will not be as cool as Missouri, although in general it's much cooler. But partial or total, this big event in gas stations across America has made us and our student producers at the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast think not just about the mystery of this eclipse, but about the role that eclipses have played in literature and in human history generally.
That's right. And fortunately, we have the perfect person on the podcast today to talk about solar eclipses and how they have influenced all types of storytelling. David Barron is an author, journalist, broadcaster, and public speaker. He formerly worked as a science correspondent for NPR and has written for many other publications, earning some of the top honors you can get in journalism. He's also an avid umbrophile, a new word for me today, meaning someone who loves to chase eclipses and has witnessed 8 total solar eclipses across the globe to date. His book, American Eclipse, about the total eclipse of 1878, was shortlisted for many awards and won the American Institute of Physics Science Writing Award. The book is now being adapted into a musical by the Tony-nominated composer and lyricist Michael John Lacusa. Am I saying that name right, David?
Lacusa, yes.
Lacusa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. So now, since we have a true umbrophile, a word that I knew before, no, I'm kidding, on the show with us, what are your plans?
I thought I would have meant you was scared of umbrellas if I had just had to do a word guess.
Yeah, I was fully, like, I was teaching this word with great enthusiasm to others this morning. What are your plans?
No, file, it wouldn't be scared. It would be that you like umbrellas. I'm sorry.
Exactly, at least that's correct.
So, David.
It's not would be umbrophobe.
David, what are your plans for the total solar eclipse this year?
Well, so, I mean, I've been anticipating this eclipse literally for decades, and the same way I'm anticipating eclipses decades from now, as long as I'm still here on Earth. On April 8th, I will be in Texas. The total eclipse on April 8th will go from Texas to Maine. It'll be a partial solar eclipse for all of North America except for Alaska. But to see it as a total eclipse, you have to be along this 115-mile-wide path. I will be in Waco, Texas, where the totality, as it's called, the total eclipse will last over 4 minutes. And gathering there with family. And also, that's where the new musical by Michael John Lacusa is going to see its world premiere April 7th at Baylor University. Broadway stars are coming down for a concert performance, so it'll be just quite a weekend for me and then the eclipse on Monday.
Now, we said in the opening to the show that we were talking about West Plains, Missouri, because I have friends who live there. So that's not actually the longest place in Missouri to watch it, although they said it would be like, the article I was looking at said it would be 3 minutes there. But there are better places in Missouri, you say?
Absolutely. Cape Girardeau will see, I think, over 4 minutes.
I know Rush Limbaugh's from there, so we can't talk about Cape Girardeau on this show.
Well, but are you going to stay with your friends there? I mean, this is an opportunity to go stay on their couch or sleep on the floor because you want to see the eclipse.
I might do that. I might. But so Cape Girardeau is the longest place, actually.
It is longer. Basically, yeah. The closer you are to the center line of the path of totality, the longer the eclipse lasts.
Okay. So, I mean, you've spent a lot of time, as we outlined, looking at eclipses, and you've written about them. What is it that may? I mean, look, there's going to be a lot of media. I've heard somebody telling me that they had booked their you know, place to go look at the eclipse a year ago because they didn't have a good hotel. I did, yeah. You know, so people are fascinated by this. The media is fascinated by it. What is the fascination? Why does this, every time it happens, become such a huge thing, whether it's this century or some other century?
Because it really is a big deal. I mean, unfortunately, so many astronomical phenomena have been just ridiculously hyped in recent years. These all think about super moons and super blood moons and meteor showers that are said to be, you know, the meteor shower of the century. And you go out, and if you see one meteor a minute, that's pretty darn good. I mean, these astronomical phenomena are interesting. A total solar eclipse is truly awe-inspiring. It is the closest thing to space travel that you can experience without leaving the surface of the Earth. And it is extremely rare for one to come to you. Yes, they occur on Earth about once every 18 months, but usually it's someplace very hard to get to. The next total eclipse that will go over my house in Boulder, Colorado, will be in the year 2772, more than 700 years from now. Any given point on Earth, on average, sees a total eclipse about once every 400 years. So it's something rare and brief and mind-boggling and truly worth the hype. So I'm thrilled that it's getting all this attention. And in years past, of course, when people didn't know how to predict them, it felt like the world was ending.
I mean, what we used to... first of all, how come then we have two so close together? I mean, there was, I remember going to see the one in 2017 with my kids. We did the whole deal. Is this just a very rare phenomenon that we're getting to in the continental U.S. so that close together?
Yeah, it's seemingly random. In fact, there are patterns to eclipses, but when you look at them across the globe, it seems to be random. And so a total eclipse is seen across a path that's like a thin stripe that the moon's shadow is literally tracing along the globe. And, you know, they will, sometimes they'll miss entire continents for decades, and sometimes two will come in quick succession. But prior to the one in 2017, there had not been a total eclipse to cross the entire continental United States in 99 years. And now we have two crossing a big chunk of the country 7 years apart. But after this, it's going to be another 20 years. So again, it's seemingly random.
So you mentioned this point 700 years in the future. I wish I could book
Colorado's going to be like an archipelago.
but of course, this also, our obsession with eclipses also goes deep into the past, and eclipses have been appearing in our art and literature for centuries. You know, Milton, Wordsworth, Thomas Hardy all featured eclipses in their poetry. And there's a Dickinson poem with an eclipse, which I will read a little snippet of. It sounded as if the streets were running, and then the streets stood still. Eclipse was all we could see at the window, and awe was all we could feel. By and by, the boldest stole out of his covert to see if time was there. Nature was in an opal apron, mixing fresher air. So what role do eclipses tend to play in literature? Why are they not so fascinating just to the general population, but also fascinating and specifically useful to writers?
Well, I think it's changed over the centuries. So before astronomers knew how to predict eclipses and before they really knew what was happening, of course, they were seen as bad omens. You know, it was something, it was nature out of order. It was supposed to be a sign from the heavens that that we needed to change our ways. And in fact, Shakespeare refers to eclipses in several of his plays. And in King Lear, he has Gloucester say, "These late eclipses in the sun and moon portend no good to us." And that was generally the idea in ancient times that, again, a total eclipse was a sign of something wrong. In more recent times, and by recent I mean in recent centuries, because it's been several centuries since astronomers were pretty good at predicting where and when eclipses would happen, they've become more just an opportunity to appreciate, as Emily Dickinson did, the awe of standing in front of natural forces so enormous and incomprehensible that they make us feel humbled. And one of my favorite essays about a total eclipse was by the 19th century novelist James Fenimore Cooper. In 1806, he witnessed a total solar eclipse in his hometown of Cooperstown, New York. He was just 17 years old. And much later in life, he wrote an essay that ended up being published posthumously, where he talked about what, again, this, he was 17 years old. He then went on to lead a very productive and interesting life. But he looked back on that eclipse as one of the most meaningful experiences in his life. And I have a brief quote in my book from that essay where he writes, "I shall," again, this is him as an older man looking back on what happened when he was 17. "I shall only say that I have passed a varied and eventful life, that it has been my fortune to see earth, heavens, ocean, and man in most of their aspects, but never have I beheld any spectacle which so plainly manifested the majesty of the Creator or so forcibly taught the lesson of humility to man as a total eclipse of the sun." And again, I think in more modern times, that's what you see, is it's an appreciation of being alive and just being in, again, whether you believe these are supernatural forces or natural forces, we are at the mercy of a universe that is so much larger than we can comprehend.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back. That's true. And I mean, I was thinking about the Dickinson poem. That was an 1891 poem called "It Sounded As If the Streets Were Running." And so that must have been about the same eclipse that you write about in your book, probably, right? Because
I don't know what she was writing about, because mine is 1878 and it was not total in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And I'm thinking about 19th.
She was born in 1830, so I was trying to figure out if there was another one in between 1830 and 1878?
There were several. There was one that was total in 1869, but that was not total in Massachusetts. There was no total eclipse in Massachusetts in those years, I am quite sure. But she might be writing of a partial eclipse, or she might simply be writing from her own imagination, as far as we know.
So the interesting thing about eclipses as like a literary device, right, is that they're not... Well, I want to mention there's also a religious aspect to this, right? Your book, they can be about awe of nature, but your book begins with a guy who runs in and kills his family because he wants to avoid end times, right? I mean, so they also, and that is, you know, a fairly, you know, in 1878, a fairly contemporary, at least, you know, like interpretation. And I still think that people, you know, there's plenty of people in this country that believe that God created the universe in X number of days and may take this as a religious portent as well. But in literature, you know, it's difficult because characters don't cause eclipses. They're a deus ex machina in a way. They're the hand of God, literally, or like as some people imagine, mm-hmm. the hand of God. And yet they do work as a narrative way of like defining a before and after. I wonder if you could just talk about the way that they are sometimes used in literature.
Well, I think they are sort of a deus ex machina because it is something that, again, unless you know how to predict it, it just comes out of nowhere and seems inexplicable and can be terrifying and can change lives and history. So a true story. And this is related by the ancient Greek historian Herodotus. In the 6th century BC, in Asia Minor, these two warring powers, the Medes and the Lydians, they'd been fighting for 6 years. And all of a sudden, in the middle of day, the sun disappears. And they considered it a sign from heaven that they needed to lay down their arms. And they made peace. So this actually happened in real life. And so, yeah, it's a wonderful technique in literature as well, if you want to suddenly have people change their ways and perhaps realize the folly of what they're doing.
I wish I could aim the eclipse at several people just hearing that. So your book, American Eclipse, covers 1878's eclipse by weaving together the stories of many Americans who witnessed it. And the book is built off both minor tales of people who witnessed the eclipse, as well as several key individuals who specifically sought out the eclipse traveling, as you were just saying that many people are doing for the upcoming one. So what made you choose, why 1878's eclipse when there are, as you were sharing with us, so many choices?
So, well, I guess I'll go back to how the book all came about, which is both out of my own personal passion for eclipses when I saw my first one in Aruba in 1998, my first total eclipse, and also out of a marketing opportunity. So it was in 1998. I was just absolutely awed when I saw my first total eclipse. And I was a science writer working in public radio, but thought I really wanted to write a book that somehow brought to life to the general public the excitement of a total eclipse. And I figured I would have the book come out first in 2017, 19 years later, because that's when the next total solar eclipse would cross the United States. And then there'd be another in 2024. So I wanted a book to come out in 2017 and also stick around for 2024. And I was looking for a good eclipse tale to tell, a good human story that centered on an eclipse. And it became pretty clear early on that the best eclipse stories are not from today, but they're from the 19th century. Because in the 19th century, particularly the latter half, total eclipses were keenly important for science, for astronomy. Astronomers were just starting to unravel the mysteries of the sun. What is this great ball of fire in the sky? What is it made of? What fuels it? And there were certain studies that they could do only during a total solar eclipse, which, as I said, happens about once every 18 months somewhere on the planet, usually someplace very hard to get to, only lasts 3 or 4 minutes. But it was so important, they'd put together these elaborate expeditions, head off to Africa or Asia or the Arctic, set up their telescopes and spectroscopes in the path of the moon's shadow, hope that clouds didn't show up, and then frantically conduct their observations in these 3 or 4 minutes. So I wanted to write a book about one of these eclipses, and I just started going through them. There was one in 1868 that went over Thailand, 1870 over the Mediterranean, 1871 over India. And then I came to 1878, and it just had everything that a writer could want. Here it was, I mean, the setting, it crossed the Wild West. The eclipse of 1878 went right down the spine of the Rockies from Montana Territory to Texas. It was the Gilded Age in the East. It was so important to science at that time. You had all of these Eastern scientists and European scientists rushing out to the Wild West. Among them was Thomas Edison. A young Thomas Edison, just before he invented the light bulb, went to Wyoming with the gunslingers and the saloons to witness this total eclipse. And also, this was a really important time in the history of science in America. We were a young country. We had just turned 100 a couple of years earlier. We were becoming an economic power, but the Europeans didn't take us seriously when it came to intellect. I mean, Europe was where the great art and literature and music and science came from. And here was America's chance to show that it could be a scientific nation. It could compete with Europe in this intellectual realm. And so it became a really big deal for the country. So Edison, I knew early on, was going to be one of my characters. There were so many interesting people, but I ended up focusing on two others as well, who I'm sure we'll talk about. But I think my favorite of the three characters was actually the most famous female scientist in America in the 19th century. Her name was Maria Mitchell. She taught at Vassar College. She taught astronomy. And in 1878, when all these men were heading out to the Wild West with their telescopes to observe the eclipse, and the government was asking them to come along, and she was excluded, she took it upon herself to put together an all-female expedition to Denver, Colorado for the eclipse of 1878. So it was just great setting, great time, and wonderful characters. And it screamed a book.
You know, we want to have you read from the book a little bit here. And one of the things that's interesting about that time frame also to me is that, as we were talking about, you have some Americans who are reacting to this from a religious perspective or a more superstitious perspective, not a scientific perspective. And then you have the scientists, right? And the way that you're juxtaposing those two viewpoints, it seems to me really important in the book. So I wondered if you could read a passage from chapter 17 where you have a father and son in rural Texas who are totally stunned and unprepared for the eclipse. And then it's sort of juxtaposed with this other character, James Craig Watson, who wants to take advantage of the eclipse as a chance to discover a new planet. Do you talk about that, you know, the way that choice stylistically, and then read that section for us?
Sure. So Again, the remarkable thing about the eclipse of 1878 was just how contemporary it seems. Astronomers knew that it was going to happen. They mapped the so-called path of totality where the moon's shadow would fall. There were eclipse tourists going out to the west. Denver ran out of hotel rooms, the same way we're seeing in Cleveland and Indianapolis and Dallas this year, the cities that are in the path of the 2024 total eclipse. So in many ways, it felt very contemporary. But there was a part of Texas, and you already alluded to this, Whitney, at the beginning of the book, I open with what happened there, because south of Fort Worth, in a rural area, there were folks who had not heard that the eclipse was coming. And this was an area of a lot of devout people where there was general talk that Christ was probably coming back sometime soon to come get his faithful. And so you have people out in their farm fields on a hot July day, and all of a sudden it goes dark, and they look up in the heavens, and what do they see? The sun is gone, and they see this beautiful heavenly crown. And they were convinced this was Christ returning, and it was Judgment Day. And they were terrified. People fell to their knees in prayer. They ran to church. And as I describe at the beginning of the book, and as I refer again to in the passage I'm about to read, there was this this father, Ephraim Miller, who didn't want to stick around for the apocalypse and decided he was going to get to the other side as quickly as possible and take his young son with him. So that I refer to in the beginning and also in this passage. And before I read the passage, I should say a bit about James Craig Watson, who, again, is my third main character. So Thomas Edison is one, Mariah Mitchell is another. James Craig Watson was a professor of astronomy at the University of Michigan. And he was known in that era as a planet hunter, which generally meant that he was really good at finding asteroids. So asteroids, which are, you know, tiny bodies that orbit the sun like the planets, back then were considered minor planets. They got names just like major planets, and finding them was a very big deal. And James Craig Watson was in this race to find more asteroids than anyone else, particularly with another American named C.H.F. Peters. The two were really dueling it out. And his Watson's goal for the eclipse of 1878 was to discover a major planet which was believed to exist and had been given a name, and that's Vulcan, right? So Vulcan, before it showed up on Star Trek as a fictional planet, was thought to be a real planet in the 19th century. It was thought to exist between Mercury and the Sun. It was thought that because Mercury's orbit seemed weird, the only way that astronomers could explain it was to assume that there was another planet closer to the Sun than Mercury that was disturbing its orbit. It was called Vulcan. No one had ever reliably seen it, but if it's that close to the Sun, it's going to set with the Sun, so you can't see it in the sky at night. You can't see it in the daytime because it's going to be lost in the Sun's glare. About the only time you might see it would be during a total eclipse, when the moon blocks the bright face of the sun, and then you can see what's right around the sun. So James Craig Watson, a highly pompous man, was convinced if anyone could find this planet during 3 minutes of a total eclipse in Wyoming in 1878, it was him. So as I read this passage, this is now right after the eclipse, where I'm describing what the news media are now reporting on that happened on that fateful day, July 29th of 1878. It would take more than a week for papers outside of Texas to relay the disturbing news of what had occurred when the moon's shadow reached the Lone Star State. There were thousands of ignorant people, both white and black, who had not heard that anything peculiar was about to happen, reported the St. Louis Globe-Democrat, which included details of the father-son murder-suicide in a salacious roundup of vice and crime headlined Satan's Carnival. A terrible tragedy in Johnson County may be set down to the eclipse, the article continued, before recounting the dreadful acts of one Ephraim Miller. When the eclipse commenced and the darkness of totality came on, he ran from the field to his house with a hatchet in his hand, the paper noted. Wishing to take his 10-year-old boy with him to the other side of Jordan, Miller raised his hatchet and split his son's head open. Leaving the latter weltering in his blood and struggling in the last throes of death, the father, on a ladder, ascended to the top of the house. Here, with a new razor, he cut his throat from ear to ear and fell to the ground a corpse. News outlets in Chicago, Boston, Salt Lake City, and elsewhere soon printed horrifying accounts of the tragedy, irresistible to an American press that often catered to readers' base interests. But the lurid tale, tucked in the back pages, was a mere postscript. The main story of the American eclipse of 1878, as it was written in the event's immediate aftermath, proved an uplifting narrative, a tale of a nation's enlightenment and undeniable progress. Professor Watson finds Vulcan, a Wyoming headline proclaimed the day after the eclipse. Word quickly spread by wire and post. A new planet discovered and the discoverer an American, wrote D.H. Talbot, the Sioux City land agent, in a dispatch back home. Englishmen may come among us and endeavor to search out the wonders of the firmament, but they cannot get ahead of American genius. The most influential of those visiting Englishmen, Norman Lockyer, editor of the journal Nature, recognized the American achievement in a letter to London's Daily News. Little doubt remains that a new major planet has been discovered, he wrote. Professor Watson's work has been acknowledged on all hands to be a veritable tour de force. Some astronomers, largely in private conversation, questioned Watson's discovery. After all, others who had searched for Vulcan during the eclipse failed to find it. Yet the prevailing opinion was summed up by the Boston Daily Advertiser, which called Watson a thoroughly competent and trustworthy observer. Indeed, the paper continued, it may be said with confidence that his keen eyes were not likely to have been deceived, or that he could have fancied he saw a planet which was not in view. The subsequent hoopla draped Watson in adulation. A man not short on ego before the eclipse, he surely accepted as fact what one newspaper now called him, the most noted astronomical observer and discoverer in the world. Another paper soon made an inevitable comparison when it wrote of Watson, he is the Edison of astronomy. On his return journey to Ann Arbor while passing through Chicago, Watson, like Edison a few weeks earlier, found himself cornered by a reporter. What are the circumstances of your discovery of Vulcan? The journalist wanted to know. Watson offered a technical response. I found a star of 4.5 magnitude in brightness, which had a decided disk and was in a position in which there is no known star, he said. The reporter clearly hoped for a more engaging quote, and he devised a way to break through the professor's decorum. The hunt for asteroids was often likened to a celestial round of billiards, and in the American rules of the game, one player might grant the other a handicap, called a discount, whereby an opponent's pocketing of a ball forced the player to deduct points from his own score. The journalist joked to Watson, "You probably will want some discount for this in the race you and Professor Peters are having, will you not?" Watson laughed. "Well, I suppose so. I wouldn't take a dozen asteroids for this." And I should note, as it was clear, Watson thought he found Vulcan. He clearly did not, because there is no planet closer to the sun than Mercury. But that was the big headline out of the eclipse of 1878, that an American astronomer made this great discovery of a new planet.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back.
Thank you so much for reading that. I'm reminded as I'm, when I was reading and I was thinking about James Craig Watson, I used to teach at the University of Michigan, where a cool feature of the building that houses the English department is that there is a teaching planetarium on the top level. So there is this there is this way that you kind of, you know, be embedded in your reading, and then you would go up and look at the stars. And it was, he's quite a character, and it was interesting to think about him in Ann Arbor. And of course,
yeah, and his observatory is still there. It's called the Detroit Observatory in Ann Arbor, but it still exists. It's a wonderful building.
There's a lot of cool astronomy stuff, I think, still going on there. And of course, as a rank amateur English professor who would sort of wander into the teaching planetarium, it was fascinating to kind of be on the fringes of it even. So Mark Twain's novel, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, was published in 1889, which was a decade and change after the eclipse in your book. And its main character is a mechanic named Hank Martin. He's transported back in time to Arthurian England. So toward the end of the novel, spoiler alert for those who have not yet gotten to that, he uses his ability to scientifically predict an eclipse to terrify and ultimately defeat his enemies. So, two questions. First, Twain surely knew about and was influenced by the eclipse of 78 when he wrote those scenes, right? And second, is the distinction between people who view eclipses scientifically and those who view them superstitiously itself a staple of the way we tell eclipse stories?
Yes and yes. First of all, actually, I wanted to include Twain more in my book. I mentioned him in passing. But he was not in the United States in the summer of 1870. He was in Europe. So he did not see the 1878 eclipse himself. But clearly he knew about it. Again, it was a very big deal. That said, what influenced him and what has become a trope in a number of books have been how eclipses are portrayed as a way to trick the natives, right? The superstitious natives by using the knowledge of an eclipse. Really, it comes from true life. That story comes from Christopher Columbus, who in the winter of 1504 was in Jamaica and was having trouble getting along with the indigenous population. They had been providing him with food and other provisions, and they decided they weren't going to do it anymore. Well, he knew, because he had a nautical almanac, sailors had these in those days, it helped them to navigate the oceans. He knew that there was going to be a lunar eclipse on the evening of February 29th. And so he told the locals that God was angry with them for how they were treating Columbus and his crew, and would show his anger by making the full moon appear flamed with wrath. And sure enough, the moon turned red, as it does in a lunar eclipse, and the people came and ran to him to beg for forgiveness. And that really happened. And I think that is what really influenced Mark Twain and a number of other books that use that same idea in the storytelling.
Great. Eclipses as a tool of colonialism. That's really
correct. Exactly.
All right. So they're not just I did not know that story. So, and that connection to Twain. So thank you for that. But, there, you know, eclipses don't just show up in literature either. I mean, the first film to feature an eclipse, according to my half-assed internet research, is The Eclipse or The Courtship of the Sun and Moon, which came out in 1907. There's an eclipse at the start of the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey. There are a number of movies that have eclipses in them. And then, of course, as we already mentioned, your book's being made into a musical featuring an eclipse. So I'm curious about how the storytelling of eclipses changes from genre to genre. Do they represent the same thing in books as they do in movies? And what is your favorite eclipse narrative? You know, who has used eclipses to, or an eclipse to the best or most original effect?
Well, so, I mean, one of the reasons I thought that a total eclipse made for a great storytelling device in my book was that it is something, I mean, here in 1878, you've got all these teams of competing scientists racing out to be in one place at the same time. They're all going to be lined up along the path of the moon's shadow in the west for an event that lasts 3 minutes. So it's just this natural climax of everyone rushing out there, and you're wondering, is the weather going to, you know, are they going to get their telescopes there in time? Is the weather going to cooperate? What will happen during those 3 minutes? So it all converges. So for me, in terms of the storytelling, I found just the eclipse makes for a great climax. And I think that's what Michael John Lacusa also saw when he decided to turn my book into a musical. Again, you just have this, you know, I mean, it's as soon as at the beginning of the musical, the various characters hear the call that there's an eclipse is going to happen in the American West 2 years hence, and the government wants to send scientists out there, that just sets the plot in motion, and it's all headed toward one moment. And interestingly, I mean, when I saw the first workshop production of this musical a little over a year ago, and I wasn't sure, was this going to translate to this medium? I think a musical is perfect because for me, a total solar eclipse is less something you see than you feel. It's such a deeply emotional, I dare say spiritual experience to be standing under this alien sky, to feel yourself, your own insignificance, that you're just floating on a rock in space. It connects people together. It's a really uniform sense of unification you have with the people around you. You're all here together and witnessing this rare and beautiful thing. What better way to convey that than through song? So that at the end of the musical, when Thomas Edison and James Craig Watson and Mariah Mitchell and an ensemble of two dozen more are singing in unison, looking up at the sky, it brings chills to me in the same way a total eclipse does. So that's an unusual way to portray an eclipse, but I actually think it works very well. Often in film, and I can't speak specifically to specific films, but generally when I see total eclipses portrayed visually, whether it's in film or honestly photoshopped pictures that people put on Facebook and they think, wow, this is beautiful, they do not capture what a total eclipse really looks like. The colors of the sky, the solar corona, which is the sun's outer atmosphere, pictures really, and I mean, most of them, and certainly movies, don't really convey what it's like. So maybe it needs to be a musical. But to answer your final question, my favorite bit of literature about a total eclipse, and I wouldn't be surprised if many of your listeners feel the same way, is an essay that was written by Annie Dillard after she saw a total eclipse in 1979. And it's the essay is called Total Eclipse. It was published in her collection, Teaching a Stone to Talk, and it recounts her journey to see a total eclipse in the Pacific Northwest in 1979. And it's what she really captures is just how surreal and otherworldly a total eclipse is. It just turns your world upside down. It's like what you're witnessing can't be real. It just doesn't fit with any of your previous experience. And she has a very famous way she describes the onset of the total eclipse after seeing the partial eclipse, because even if you're in the path where it's total, you're going to see a partial eclipse as the moon slowly makes its way in front of the sun, and the sun becomes a crescent, which is what everyone in North America, except for Alaska, will see on April 8th if the skies are clear and if you're protecting your eyes. But if you're in the path of totality, when the moon finally covers the last bit of the sun, it's completely different. And what Annie Dillard wrote was, seeing a partial eclipse bears the same relation to seeing a total eclipse as kissing a man does to marrying him, or as flying in an airplane does to falling out of an airplane. Although the one experience precedes the other, it in no way prepares you for it. And I should say, when she says marrying a man, I think she's being polite. This is a euphemism. After all, she was writing this like 1979. I mean, it's the difference between kissing your sibling and passionate lovemaking. That's the difference between a partial eclipse and a total eclipse. A partial eclipse is interesting. A total eclipse is all-consuming.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back. I was thinking about how actually there were fewer movies when I was looking into this that have used eclipses. And I was thinking about how many movies there are, anecdotally in my mind, that use other kinds of natural disasters. Earthquakes, tons of movies with earthquakes. Volcano eruptions, tons of movies with volcano eruptions. Tsunamis, very popular movie trope. And I was thinking, well, why is that? Why are there more eclipses? Why are there so many eclipses in writing and fewer in film? And I thought, well, it's because an eclipse, like you were saying, is an emotional thing. It's not like, it's not going to kill you like an earthquake does. You don't have to run from it or hide. It's about the way that you perceive it. And literature is good at that. And movies are not particularly good at internal perception. They're good at how things move around outside, you know? And so it makes sense to me that like eclipses would be in some way favored by literature or an essayist like Annie Dillard or a poet like Dickinson.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And also a total eclipse, as we've already said, it doesn't actually change anything physically. It's going to last a few minutes and then it's over. What it's changing maybe is how people feel or it might end a war or something, but you're not going to be able to depict like you would a volcanic eruption destroying a town.
Yeah, there's nothing for The Rock to do. He can't hang from a helicopter and save people during the eclipse.
I'm going to have to offer a counter argument for this because I'm pretty sure that I learned what a total eclipse was in 1987, a year that there was no total eclipse except for on screen in Superman 4, Quest for Peace. It was like a formative moment for me in narrative. And in that movie, Superman causes an eclipse to save the world. And by doing so, he basically powers down his nemesis, who, like him, is powered by the sun. It was sort of like the Rocky IV, like Cold War era films. And so in this case, his nemesis was Nuclear Man. So he turns up Superman using his scientific brain, turns off the sun, makes his enemy powerless, and then throws him into a nuclear reactor. So you see this on screen. And I was looking this up before this episode. And one of the things it shows up as is like one of the worst movie special effects you've ever seen in your life. And for me, it was like the first time I'd ever seen it. And I just remember feeling, I mean, such awe, actually. You know, this is like a Christopher Reeve era Superman. And so for me as a kid, like that was the one that I knew. And it also exists at this interesting intersection of science and superstition, right? Like the superhero and his intelligence, actually, like not his superpowers, are the thing that defeats it. And this eclipse, like the notion that the sun could be totally knocked out was so astonishing to me. And so it is also my role on this podcast kind of to bring in the examples that are slightly trashier like this one. So I'm also going to say that I think we all deserve a medal for not having mentioned Total Eclipse of the Heart yet. We did not get into music, but like you know, Annie Dillard's got this metaphor about kissing and marrying, or yes, kissing and euphemism, et cetera. And there, like total eclipses used as a metaphor for being completely in love. And it is something about like the totality and completeness, the utter darkness. And also something like about scope. Like it's fascinating to me how many of these scientists pursuing this, like it's not just James Craig Watson, who's like a little bit of an egomaniac. It's like a lot of people who are seeking to prove their own importance in relation to the sky. What do you think about that? Is that...
Well, I mean, it's total eclipses also, again, for me, having chased them around the world, I mean, having seen 8 of them now on 5 continents and about to see my 9th, I'm not trying to prove anything to anyone else, but they're really meaningful to me. I mean, it's... And eclipse chasing is a thing. Clearly, it's a cult, you might say. It's a small community, but there, when you consider the number of people in the world, but there are a considerable number of eclipse chasers. And in fact, there is a site, eclipsechasers.com, I think it is, or maybe it's .org, and there's a hyphen in there too, but where people can, you can log the eclipses you've seen, and it's, so you can be ranked in who's seen the most total eclipses, or who you can see how many minutes you've actually spent in the shadow of the moon over your lifetime. And I don't want to suggest that there's that much competition going on. It's more of an internal thing. But I just find great peace and comfort and joy standing in the shadow of the moon, being an umbrophile. I love the shadow of the moon. That's where the word comes from. So it is something that can influence people in a powerful way. But even the scientists, you know, back in 1878, it was really interesting to read. There were a number of the scientists who would complain that they had to do their work during the eclipse because they just wanted to look at it. They just wanted to revel in the beauty of it. And they kind of resented that they had tasks to do in those few minutes. So they saw the beauty as well.
So this year's eclipse is the last that will touch the contiguous U.S. for over 20 years until 2044 and 2045. So the stories that we tell and remember about this eclipse will hold power for a long time. So when you look that far forward on a personal or societal level, how do you think this eclipse will be remembered?
I think it's going to be a very big deal. I mean, will it change history? Maybe not. But if we look back at 2017, so the last total eclipse to cross the United States, August 21st, 2017, came at a difficult time in America. This was the beginning of the first year of Donald Trump's presidency, when it kind of felt like we were on the verge of a new civil war. It was, you know, red states versus blue states. Just a week before the total eclipse was the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville that turned deadly. Things seemed to be falling apart. But for that one day, people really did come together. You had folks from New York City driving down to Tennessee and from Denver up to Wyoming. We had people mingling who don't usually come together and who were just enjoying being together. I mean, I write about this in the afterword to a new paperback edition of my book about the 2017 eclipse, and the many people who commented on how everyone just got along and suddenly felt connected again. There was a study done of tweets, people posting on Twitter on that day, where the tweets were less about me, they were about us. People were expressing awe on Twitter. it really was a moment where people felt like we were in it together. And that was an important moment to feel that way. And I'm sure that April 8th of this year, we will be feeling the same way. All of America, all of North America, except Alaska, will see this as either a partial or a total eclipse. It's going to have, you know, wall-to-wall coverage on television. It's going to be very hard to ignore it. Everyone will feel caught up in it. I don't claim that suddenly we're going to start being able to get bills passed in Congress, but at least maybe it'll remind us of what it feels like to be unified, and perhaps that'll help turn down the temperature a little bit.
David, thanks so much for joining us, listeners. Don't miss American Eclipse and David's other work, available in your local independent bookstore.
Thank you both very much. This was great fun.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Ann Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!